This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee recessed late Thursday after some 14 hours of debate. Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler said that the group will reconvene Friday at 10 a.m. Washington time to vote on articles of impeachment against U.S. President Trump. The Democratic-controlled committee on Thursday rebuffed Republican attempts to weaken or throw out the allegations and instead are voting to send them to the full House. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Five times the Republicans offered amendments to water down or even scuttle the two articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, all failing by the same tally.
17 ayes and 23 noes.
And the amendment is not agreed to.
Louisiana Democrat Cedric Richmond, late in the debate, expressed his frustration.
They just throw a whole bunch of stuff at the wall, hope that they confuse the American people, hope that something sticks.
Texas Republican Louie Gohmert argued that the majority Democrats have been searching for anything to hang on Trump.
You give us what we want until we find a crime, or we're going to throw you out of office.
Tim McGuire, Washington.
Exit polls in Britain indicate that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party will win a majority of seats in Parliament, meaning Johnson's plan to lead the EU by January 31st could begin soon. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda.
Votes are still being counted, but the Conservatives are projected to earn a massive win, about 368 seats in Westminster when the dust settles. That's up from 298. Jeremy Corbyn and his opposition Labour Party, the man who would have replaced Johnson, projected to be down to 191 from 243. Smaller parties are filling out the rest with no decisive changes. This is the third election in less than 4 years for the UK. Exit polls suggest it may have been the most decisive in decades.
That's Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reporting. This is VOA News. A senior U.S. official says that Washington's sanctions against Iran have sharply curbed Tehran's access to foreign currency, leaving it only $10 billion of accessible reserves to ferment violence and suffering at home and abroad. U.S. Special Representative for Iran, Brian Hook, shared what he said were newly declassified details of Iran's foreign exchange reserves in a speech to the Council of Foreign Relations in Washington. The Trump administration has said that its campaign also is aimed at pressing Iran's Islamic rulers to negotiate a new deal to replace a 2015 agreement they reached with world powers. An announcement from the Trump administration regarding China is expected Friday, AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
With the clock ticking down on U.S. tariffs set to take effect Sunday, the United States and China are close to finalizing a modest trade agreement. On Twitter Thursday, President Donald Trump said, getting very close to a big deal with China. They want it, and so do we. That set off a day-long rally on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed with a gain of 220 points. The current talks have been on the so-called Phase 1 agreement, with the next phase expected to be more difficult. The trade war between the U.S. and China has gone on for 17 months. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Experts are now saying that Washington's call for a five-fold increase in Seoul's share of its defense cost is an untimely demand that could put the readiness of the combined U.S. and South Korean forces at risk at a time when North Korea is escalating threats. Lawrence Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration and currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, said that this is the worst time to be having this debate between the U.S. and South Korea. Washington and Seoul are engaged in a dispute over the cost-sharing deal set to expire at the end of the year. A New Zealand military team that landed on a volcanic island on Friday recovered six of eight bodies, and they're sending them back to the capital city, Wellington. Experts say that White Island, located about 50 kilometers off the east coast of New Zealand's North Island, is still spewing steam and is highly volatile, adding that it could erupt at any time. Mike Clement is the New Zealand Police Deputy Commissioner. He says recovery crews have hindered or are hindered by the weight of their equipment and the toxic environment.
Because they have to be protected from the environmental factors that are there on the island, and we have to be prepared for the fact that there might be an eruption because we can't eliminate that. So they have to move slowly, effectively.
The volcano is a popular tourist destination for day trips. It erupted on Monday, spewing ash and steam over the island. The death toll stands at 16. More than two dozen people are being treated for severe burns in New Zealand and Australia. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Money Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Thursday's Algeria election was marred by protests.
Hundreds of protesters gathered outside Algiers' iconic post office building, the epicenter of months of popular protests, chanting slogans against Thursday's presidential election.
SBO's Edward Urania in Cairo, Egypt. The president of the ICC will explain the processes of accepting and prosecuting a case. Prolonged Zimbabwe doctor's strike makes mission hospitals the last port of hope. Cameroon recalls daily Boko Haram attacks along its border with Nigeria. And Nigeria's president relaxes visa rules for African passport holders.
The visa policy will mean that Nigeria is making progress in aligning itself with the decision made by the AU around mobility on the continent and also the free movement of goods.
Ibrahim Khan is a human rights activist working on the free movement of people in Africa. And Sierra Leone is told to rescind its ban on pregnant girls in schools. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's posts are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Observers in Algeria say turnout was fairly low for Thursday's presidential election amid reports on social media of scattered violence and large protests in various parts of the country. VOA's Edward Urania reports from Cairo.
Hundreds of protesters gathered outside Algiers' iconic post office building, the epicenter of months of popular protests, chanting slogans against Thursday's presidential election. Some could be heard shouting, "Down with the dictator," amid the din of the crowd. Algeria has had an interim president since protests forced former leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika to resign in April. Algerian TV showed an election official proclaiming that turnout at 11 a.m. had surpassed 7% across the country, despite a number of irregularities. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV's correspondent in the capital, Algiers, reported that turnout at one polling station on the outskirts of the capital had climbed to approximately 15% by mid-afternoon, amid what appeared to be general apathy. Several Algerian media outlets reported that turnout had reached 20% nationwide by 4 p.m., quoting an unnamed election official. A spokesman for a group of young protesters calling themselves youth movers alleged that cheating was taking place because government media were showing crowds at polling stations while few people actually turned out to cast ballots. VOA could not independently confirm his claim. Amateur video posted on social media showed a crowd of mostly young demonstrators forcing their way into a polling station in Tizi Ouzou as several young men seized voting urns and spilled ballots on the ground. Some older Algerians told Arab media that they supported the holding of a presidential election despite the opposition of many fellow citizens. A man in his 70s says he respects the views of the protesters, but that he favors holding the election because it is better to elect a president and have a legitimate authority in the country. Azzedine Mayoubi, one of five men running for president, told Algerian media that Algerians should vote because it is their civic duty. He says that those who disagree should respect the will of the people who want to vote and put the interests of the nation above their own personal interests or the agendas of various groups. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A human rights activist is welcoming Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's decision to allow African passport holders to apply for visas upon arrival in Nigeria. Mr. Buhari made the announcement Wednesday in Cairo, Egypt, during the Aswan Forum on Peace and Sustainable Development. Ibrahima Khan, a human rights activist working on the free movement of people in Africa, says he's not surprised by President Buhari's decision. In fact, he says the Nigerian president's announcement is in line with the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States ECOWAS policies on the free movement of Africans within the continent.
It's not for me a surprise. First, because since this year, Nigeria introduced already the e-visa for foreigners coming to Nigeria through airports. Two, Nigeria is one of the leaders in ECOWAS, and ECOWAS has introduced 2 years ago an ECOWAS ID, allowing people to use ID to travel within the region. So for me, the decision taken by the president of Nigeria today is just a kind of follow-up of what Nigeria is doing to ease access to its territory by all African.
Although Nigeria is the last nation now to join the new Africa Free Trade Zone, it did that in July of this year. What would this new visa policy mean?
The visa policy will mean that Nigeria is making progress in aligning itself with the decision made by the AU around mobility on the continent and also the free movement of goods. You recall that since 2016, the African Development Bank was publishing what they call the Visa Openness Index. The first document put Nigeria at the 33rd position. And this kind of decision will really make Nigeria among the 20 or the 15 countries on the continent that are really open their doors and their windows to any African who wants to travel in their country. And I think that really a very good signal by Nigeria about its commitment regarding the continent, but also regarding West Africa.
It seems to be a contradiction because sometime in August, the Nigerian government closed its borders with neighboring countries, what it called then to block contraband products. And so now with this announcement, what does this mean? Is this a contradiction or what?
Not really a contradiction. You know, when Nigeria closed its borders with Benin, it was a closure of the border for the entrance of goods, not the entrance of people. People really continue to use the same border to enter Nigeria. I think the border issue between Nigeria and Benin is very specific because it's a problem between the two countries. But it doesn't mean that Nigeria is closing its door to all Africans. West Africans are still traveling to Nigeria. But I think you need to differentiate the opening of the Nigerian space to African and the specific problem between Nigeria and Benin, which is a very complex one. But I think Nigeria and Benin are trying to sort it out. Probably by January, this problem will be sorted out because it's related to specific issues between the two countries.
Ibrahima Khan is a human rights activist working on the free movement of people in Africa. He was speaking with us from Libreville, Gabon. The president of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Judge Chile Ebue Osoji, has denied that the ICC is targeting Africans for political purposes. He also explains the processes that the ICC uses to decide which cases to investigate and prosecute. Judge Ebue Osoji was in Washington, D.C. this week and spoke with viewers Peter Clotty.
For the case to come to be picked up by the court, it needs to come through the referral of somebody, typically the state in whose territory the situation occurred, or the state whose national is accused of wrongdoing. Typically, these are states party to the Rome Statute. You make a referral. There may be instances where a non-state party to the Rome Statute may still make a referral and then basically indicate that they're happy to do that and by follow the judgments of the court. Another way a case can come to the ICC is if the Security Council refers the case, typically because that situation may have occurred in the territory of a state that is not a state party to the Rome Statute. So right. Under the auspices of the United Nations Security Council mandate for international peace and security, then they get to refer, the Security Council may then refer a case to the ICC. Darfur
right.
situation. Another one was Libya.
Right.
So those are the two ways cases come to the ICC. But
one of the criticisms is also that the court targets Africans. They say that for a majority of the cases being handled at the court, most of them are African-related. As an African yourself, when you hear such criticisms, how do you react to that?
I can tell you bluntly that I'm not impressed by those criticisms. It's when people tell me that, I tell them, on whose behalf are you speaking? Are you speaking on behalf of the 800,000 Tutsi victims who were victims of the genocide in Rwanda? Are you speaking on behalf of the how many people in Sierra Leone who were amputated, hands amputated by their fellow human beings right. who felt they could do that? Who are you speaking on behalf of when you say court is targeting Africans, targeting those victims? Or is the complaint that perhaps the court is taking up questions of humanity in which there are African victims? If that the narrative, is that a complaint? That's usually why I'm not impressed by those complaints.
So what do you see as the ICC's role in Africa going forward, let's say in the next 5-10 years to come?
For Africans, the matter of economic development is hugely important. Where war is erupting, you don't have economic activities going on. So this is one area where the ICC has value, in the sense putting pressure against those kinds of conduct so that people don't engage with them with as much of an ease as used to be the case before the creation of the ICC.
That's George Chile Obuwe Osuji, the president of the International Criminal Court. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty here in our Washington studio. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington today. It's Friday, December 13, Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. With no end in sight to the Zimbabwe doctor's strike over salaries and poor working conditions, desperate patients have looked to church-run hospitals for much-needed health care. Karanda Mission Hospital, about 200 kilometers north of the capital, Harare, is overwhelmed by patients seeking treatment. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mount Darwin near Zimbabwe's border with Mozambique.
This evangelical church-run hospital was established in the 1960s to cater for patients in the Mount Darwin district of Zimbabwe. But because of a government doctor strike which began 3 months ago, people like 39-year-old Darlington Henderson are traveling hundreds of kilometers to be treated here. Henderson, who has a broken hip, says he arrived more than 2 weeks ago. The place is flooded with people, says Henderson. He was told he would be seen on November 29, but doctors said they had more urgent cases, so he was told to come back this week. If I do not get treated now, he says, they said it will be in January. Canadian Dr. Paul Thistle is head of Karanda Mission Hospital. He says their patient numbers have more than doubled in the last 2 months.
That's put stresses on our human resources, our nurses, our doctors, plus our physical resources and medicines and surgical supplies. So Karanda is seen as the port of last hope for some people who have failed to access services elsewhere in the country.
Mercy Taderera is with her 13-year-old Tanaswa Mapfufu, who has a bladder infection. Their 300-kilometer journey hasn't resulted in a meeting with a doctor. Hence Taderera's plea to President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government and the doctors on strike. I wish they would value people's lives. So many people have died because of doctor strike. This is an appeal to both. The government must attend to the doctors' concerns, she says. International aid organizations have over the years funded Zimbabwe's neglected social sector, but that help has largely consisted of providing drugs and technical support. No help on salaries, which the doctors want increased to cope with soaring inflation.
Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Mount Darwin, Zimbabwe.
Authorities in Cameroon say Boko Haram terrorists have been launching daily attacks on villages along the Nigerian border, killing at least 30 people and injuring scores in the past few months. A high-level security meeting has recommended that traditional rulers, the clergy, and civilians work together with the military to help reduce the attacks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more from Mora, Cameroon.
55-year-old cattle rancher Lamsi Gilgio, speaking through an interpreter, asked for temporary housing at the central mosque in the town of Mora on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. He says Boko Haram militants attacked his ranch in Wewak village on Tuesday, and it is still not safe for him to return. Gutio says as he went to negotiate with cattle buyers, Boko Haram terrorists attacked his ranch, probably thinking that he had collected money for the animals. He says when his wife and neighbors saw the fighters and alerted him of the danger, he escaped on his motorcycle. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Mijiyawa Bakari, says the attack on Wewak was just one among 100 they have recorded in the past 3 months. Bakari said the Boko Haram attacks left at least 30 people dead in villages around Mora, Tokombere, Limani, Kolofata, and Ashikashia.
Avec l'arrivée de la saison sèche, nous connaissons des incursions.
Bakari says with the arrival of the dry season 3 months ago, incursions by Boko Haram terrorists from Nigeria into Cameroon have been increasing. Bakari says Boko Haram fighters usually step up their attacks at the end of the year when cross-border traffic increases so they can steal supplies. But 26-year-old teacher at the Mora government school, Therese Dudu, blames the attacks on the absence of Cameroon military in the villages. She says the troops left just months ago, claiming they were no longer needed because peace had returned. She says they would not have been suffering from apparently ceaseless Boko Haram attacks if the military had remained in sufficient numbers. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for a decade to establish an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria's northeast and began attacks inside Cameroon in 2014. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Cameroon.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has urged the Sierra Leone government to immediately revoke its ban on pregnant girls in schools. Marta Koloma of Amnesty International's West Africa office tells Ricky Shryak the ECOWAS ruling brings renewed hope.
I think that the fact that ECOWAS has ruled in favor of these pregnant girls is a moral victory, because obviously is it clear it has been proved that the policy of the government is illegal, as you mentioned, but it's also against the human rights of pregnant girls in Sierra Leone.
As Amnesty says, there is a defense that it is morally wrong, but also logistically speaking, Sierra Leone put this into effect because of and during the Ebola crisis, which has not been a factor in this for years. So what is their reasoning behind keeping this ban in place?
This is since Amnesty started the search and the campaign on this issue in 2015, and as you well mentioned, it was after the Ebola period. But the problem is that the government continues with this reasoning, the saying that pregnant girls should be banned from education, because the main reasons what they say, and this is there is a statement from the President Madabio from this year, reiterating this policy, and saying that basically they are banned because they are a bad example for other girls. The fact of allowing pregnant girls to go to school will do that other girls want to get pregnant. This is the main reasoning of the government. Obviously, we don't agree what the government are saying.
Is there a sense of hope now? Is there a sense of, have you spoken to your colleagues in Sierra Leone, or are you guys hopeful that this will lead to girls being able to go back to school?
We know it's like I was talking to someone and it's like we didn't win the war. We just won a battle. This is a first step. You know, as I said, it's like since 2015, Amnesty has been involved on this case. But there are a lot of other partners in Sierra Leone and internationally that have been fighting for the rights of these girls. And this is a very, very important first step. As I said, it's like now we have a paper. We have a ruling from an ECOWAS court that says that this policy is illegal and is discriminatory and should be revoked immediately. So now we are going to carry on fighting for the implementation, the enforcement of this ruling until all pregnant girls in Sierra Leone have the right to education and they are not discriminated just for the fact of being pregnant.
That was Martha Koloma, a campaigner with Amnesty International's West Africa office. She spoke with Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Kenya, where FIFA has ordered Kenya's Football Federation to hold its elections before the end of the federation's current term in February 2020. FKF had scheduled its national elections to be held on December the 7th, but the Sports Dispute Tribunal annulled the process, citing irregularities, and ordered the next poll to be held within 6 months. FIFA Governance Services Manager Sarah Solemale said FIFA is closely monitoring the situation to ensure the compliance of the Sports Dispute Tribunal decision is done and also within a reasonable amount of time.
At the end of the duration of the president's term and the full executive committee's term, which is supposed to end by 10 February 2020, election can be held. FIFA is very strict on that. So overall, let's say we can be flexible and give an additional month, but the first trimester of 2020 will have to hold the FKF election.
We now turn our attention to the SACAFA Senior Challenge Cup, where actions resume on Friday with two semi-final slots up for grabs, with Uganda and Kenya already through to the semi-finals of this year's SACAFA Senior Men's Challenge Cup. Djibouti and Eritrea will tussle it out on Friday in a must-win encounter. Kenya, however, will return to action with hopes of booking a semifinal spot when they take on Zanzibar on Saturday. Francis Kamazi is Harambee Stars coach.
We also did not come for any easy match because we haven't played any match that was so easy either. But any opponent whom we're going to face him with a lot of dedication and commitment to get some points.
For host Uganda, they qualify for the knockout phase top of the pile with a 100% record after beating Eritrea 2-0 in their final group match. Ugandan coach Jonathan McKinstry insists his side deserved to make it to the semifinals of the SACAFA Seniors Challenge Cup in Kampala.
So when you make changes like we did today, you expect tactically sometimes things not to be perfect, but the basics of the game, passing, receiving, you know, moving into space, pressing when you're out of position, those things, it doesn't matter if you're playing regularly or not, they should be the basics.
Elsewhere, Ghana Football Association President Kurt Okraku has held a meeting with FIFA President Gianni Infantino at the headquarters of FIFA in Switzerland. The meeting, held at the instance of the FIFA president, touched on a wide range of issues on Ghana football, including administration, refereeing, coaching, finance, and logistics. And that does it for Daybreak Africa Sports for this Friday. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, December 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of the indigenous people of Biafra, talks about the efforts and challenges to secede from Nigeria. The struggle for independence on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
summertime in the Southern Hemisphere. But if you're north of the equator, Border Crossings will bring you some warmth with our Psychedelic Sunshine Show. You'll hear from the best Californian musicians of the 60s, like Sonny and Cher, the Monkees, and the Beach Boys. Tune into Border Crossings on December 19th for the grooviest songs in the world, only on The Voice of America.